This is my father, Bill Cooper.
I'm glad to finally meet you. Thank you. Jill's told me a great deal about you, and, well, it's nothing like meeting face to face.
No, sir.
Please, have a seat.
Thank you.
This is our traditional family dinner.
If you don't mind me saying, everything looks delicious.
It is. Shall we?
Thank you, Lord, for this food. We ask you to bless our guest, Jack, and this special meal and our time together. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Let's eat. Amen. Let's eat.
Please pass me those bourbon mashed potatoes.
Oh. Well, that's quite an impressive career you've had.
Oh, yes.
War correspondent for the Associated Press?
Yes. It's a joy to be a reporter. I've been very fortunate.
Oh, your parents must be very proud.
Oh, yes.
I wouldn't know.
Oh, I'm glad. I think these are the best bourbon mashed potatoes you've ever made.
Well, what do you mean you wouldn't know?
We haven't talked in 10 years.
Are they in some kind of a coma?
We had a falling out.
Well, what kind of falling out?
Over religion.
Yours or theirs?
Both, in fact.
Well, what are they?
They're Baptists.
Well, all right.
And you are?
I'm an atheist.
I'm gonna need another helping of bourbon mashed potatoes.
I'm not quite sure I heard you correctly. Did you say you don't talk to your parents because you're a Methodist?
The boy said atheist, Gladys.
I knew it was something peculiar.
And, you never told my daughter what you were?
No, sir, I never told her.
No, I can't believe...
I'll handle this. So, that's why you and your folks don't speak?
Yes, sir.
Well, at least it shows you come from good parents.
Oh.
So, you don't believe in God?
I deny the existence of God, yes.
Damn! Wow. Okay, wait. So what about Jesus? You don't believe in Jesus either?
At least as a son of God, that is.
I never thought I'd say anything like this as long as I live, but I can't eat my own cooking.
So you became an atheist when, after seeing some traumatic event covering the war?
Or maybe somebody dropped you on your head when you were a baby or something like that.
I said I'll handle this.
Actually, sir, it was a decision based on science, reason, and logic.
I see.
With all due respect, sir, we just have different philosophies, that's all.
I don't have a philosophy. I have a faith.
Praise his
name.
There
you go. We better preach that.
Yep. Hey, listen, let me ask you a question. Okay, let's just say you're driving late at night in the back country roads of Georgia, and you look in your rearview mirror and you see a state trooper, he's driving up on you all close and slow. Now you got an open can of Budweiser in the car, your taillight's busted, your seatbelt ain't on, and you're rolling with a white girl.
Oh.
So now you trying to tell me you don't start saying, please God, God, please God, don't let this man stop me. Please don't let this state trooper pull me over.
Yeah, that's what he said.
That's what I say.
These potatoes are so good.
Just so I can understand this. So if I were a drug dealer or a bank robber, and I go to church and I confess my sins, you would welcome me with open arms?
Hmm.
But because I'm an atheist, I can't be forgiven?
Because a drug dealer and a bank robber can be saved.
Oh, praise his name, thank you, hallelujah.
And I can't? I thought your God forgives everybody.
Oh, he does. And when he gets around to you, you come back and see me.
Maladjusted Life Podcast, James Murray here. Today, my guest is Alex Jules. Alex is a secular activist based in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thank you very much for having me.
For those who are not familiar with you, can you tell us about tell us about your activism in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and just your activism in general.
My activism in general. I've been an out atheist for maybe, I mean, really for, oh goodness, maybe a good almost 20 years, not quite 20 years, but almost 20 years. And I really decided to jump into it mostly because of family, my son specifically. There was a big issue with him when he decided that he was going to, come out as an atheist. I was already an atheist. And we were bringing Camp Quest, Texas, which is a secular camp to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And the news got wind of it. So, of course, there were protests and, because you have a secular camp with 10 kids, like I think it was a total of like 9-10 kids total, but they wanted to interview somebody. Mm-hmm. And my son, being the oldest one, said, "Hey, I'm going to go ahead and do this." I said, "Hold on a second. We're in Texas. We're in North Texas, which is a little conservative.
Right.
Do you really want to do this? Because there might be some ramifications that we'll deal with later." And he was just, 13, 14 years old, just going into high school. And I'm like, "Okay, you're going to do this? We're going to do this, and we're just going to deal with whatever happens, right?" Like, "Yes, okay." And so he did it. And this was in August. September happened. September came and went, no issues. October came and went, no issues. Here comes Thanksgiving, and we've all forgotten about it. Turns out a couple of the local churches got access to his video or to the news clip, and they were circulating it all over Dallas and Fort Worth. And my son became the poster boy for their new campaign. "The atheists are coming for you." And he got cornered in it wasn't the cafeteria, it was in the hallway. And some of the kids, black kids, and now it's North Texas, which means that minorities are minorities. Mm-hmm. But these children came up to him and says, "You're black. How can you be an atheist? How can you not believe in Jesus?" And as upset as I wanted to be about the entire situation, the entire, "Hey, how dare you?" And the school did behave well because they did rough them up some. And so they, suspension and all that. I mean, they didn't, jump them in or anything, but it was an issue. But as much as I wanted to be angry with these kids or these kids' parents, the reality hit me right there. It's like, they really don't know any better. They don't. I mean, I grew up in the church, and the idea of being black and not Christian or black and not religious, that was very foreign to me. And I knew it was really very foreign to them. And if I was going to do anything, I mean, I could be angry. I could really be angry, or I could do something about it. And it wasn't too long after I decided that I was going to be a little bit more active, a little bit more visible, and decided to become really very vocal. And so that was the actual start of my activism, my real activism, because I just set out to change the idea that you can't be black and not religious. So that was the jump off for me.
All right.
Not too long after that, I really did start engaging locally here in Dallas with whether it was the local atheist community or, interfaith events, et cetera. Started talking to them really deeply about this idea of, why is it that you believe that blacks can only be Christian, given that historically that was never the case. That just was not the case. In our long history of being black, in our long history of even being free prior to being shipped over here and into the new world, Christianity hasn't always been the norm. So can we talk about why it is you must believe or you must adhere to this idea of this Black monolithic image of Black Christianity. And so eventually that turned into billboards and speaking events, and I guess it was a feature set in Ebony magazine that really got the dialogue going, because of course being Black and atheist was taboo, extraordinarily taboo then. It's getting less taboo now, and we're having real conversations about it. I think, I mean, we're not seeing the numbers that white America is seeing, but we are seeing some shift, and that's awesome.
I've always compared it to be out as an atheist and be Black is almost a form of social suicide.
Yeah.
But going into, outside of your activism, going into your beliefs or lack thereof, you say you started off in the church, and I'm curious to know what exactly were you introduced to, were you exposed to that kind of got you to look at, say, religion differently and to be more skeptical toward it?
I grew up in, I'm originally from New York, but my family is, West Indian.
Okay.
And so we had the Catholic backdrop. And so I was always in AME churches with my friends, but I had the Catholic church there, and it was a predominantly Black Catholic church because it's in New York and it's in Brooklyn. I mean, you can ask and get any and every flavor of Catholic or anything else in a city like New York, which is being highly pluralistic. But so that was the backdrop. And my mother did something that, she hates the fact that I'm an atheist, but as I painted the portrait for her growing up, it's like, you set me up to be an atheist, because I grew up in the church, and because it was, a Haitian and Jamaican church, there was always this influence of the occult that was always in the background. So you had voodoo and, with the immigrants that would come over, which was great because it made for a lot of theater, but it made for theater in the church, and this dynamic of, is this real? Is this not real? And this goes completely against orthodoxy. It goes completely against the doctrine and what you're teaching it, et cetera. And there were a lot of questions that I wound up fomenting. And my mother was so religious that she didn't believe that the Catholic Church was religious enough. And so for school, for me, she decided that no Catholic school in the New York Archdiocese was religious enough. So she sent me to a Seventh-day Adventist
school. Wow. Wow.
Which is a cult. I mean, it's not cult-like. It is a cult. I mean, the way that you live, what you can eat, I mean, everything there. But and it was pure indoctrination, first grade, you graduate first grade when you do all the regular rigors of math, reading, writing, arithmetic, and memorizing 100 verses a year. That was what the requirements were for moving up. Right. So how well do you know your Bible? And that was a problem, because here I am on Sundays hearing one set of a mass or a sermon, and then listening Monday through Friday, and then occasionally on Saturdays, I'm listening to these ministers, Protestant or SDA ministers, talk about how Catholicism, is the literal, the bride of the devil. I mean, it was insane to me. And a lot of the questions that I would ask my Catholic priest were around the very beginning, the origin story, and what was real, what was not real, et cetera. And it's just allegory. And then you go to the Seventh-day Adventist school, and it's like, no, this is the literal.
It's literal.
Right? I mean, it is literal. It's like, okay, hold on. Both of you are confusing me. Let me go ask you know, my friendly neighborhood synagogue, my friendly neighborhood rabbi, which was just up the road. I mean, I was in Brownsville, and so not too far, you know, getting to the East New York and East Flatbush, et cetera. You just find people. And so you walk in, you have a conversation. It's like, you guys started writing the story. Can you tell me, story to begin with, Judaism, what you believe? And then I'm like, okay, wait a minute. That's completely different than what I'm hearing from both of these. And so I continuously got these competing theories of how we became who we are and what the beginning looked like. It's 2,000 years old, it's 6,000 years old. No, it's millions of years old. Don't believe that. Hell isn't real. Hell is just separation from God, et cetera. I'm like, stop. And eventually when I got into high school, and growing up, I made a joke. To my mom, is like, you realize that I was more religious than, and prayed more than most Muslims, right? I mean, I was doing more than five times a day because you woke up, you went to bed, right? Morning prayers, evening prayers. Every time that you ate, before you put anything into your mouth, you were praying. Wow. Because I was at a Seventh-day Adventist, right? So you thank God for being able to walk into the school and keeping you safe. Mm-hmm. You thank God or you pray to God hoping that he's going to keep you safe on the way home. Of course, you had your meal, you know, for dinner. And you sat there and you ate, you prayed before you ate your dinner and every single other meal. And then, of course, you had the bedtime prayers. So I was talking to God more than I was talking to my mom some days, right? And she was just, you know, I understand that she was doing the best that she could, trying to keep me safe and hoping that a deity would do that growing up in that neighborhood, in that era, prior to gentrification. And then I got into high school. In high school, you know, in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, I went to school outside of my neighborhood. I grew up in Brooklyn, but then I went to high school in the Bronx. And that's where I got to see real diversity, and not just diversity in skin color and tone, et cetera, but skin color and belief. Not just skin, but other ideas and beliefs. I really got to meet my first Hindu, my first Muslims, you know, Shia, and you know, the NOI is always in the background somewhere, right? So we had those, right? But you know, Shia, Muslims, Sunnis, and then I also met my first non-believers. Now I grew up so. If you ask me from the age of 5 to 13 what I wanted to be, anyone who knew me between those ages was, Alex wants to be a priest, and there's nothing that's going to stop it. Right? From 5 to 13, that's all I wanted to be. That's all I wanted to do. And even though I had a love affair with math and science, I was sure that I would be able to reconcile those passions with my beliefs, until someone in high school reminded me, you know, that didn't work out so well for Galileo, right? Good point. Sure. Good point. But you know, it didn't waver my beliefs, or it didn't waver my faith. And in fact, I was one of those guys that had two Bibles in my backpack at any point. I had about a 90-minute one-way trip to high school for about 4 years, right? So, and that's 90 minutes each way, going from Brooklyn to the Bronx. And so the first year or two, I was always ready to throw down with a non-believer or someone who was different. You wanted to talk about religion. You know, I was there to defend Christianity just to the end, until I got sidetracked with many. How do you answer some of these questions on origin, given what we really know? It's like, how cognitive dissonance is strong, but it wasn't that strong for me. Eventually I found myself trying to argue the other side, and that's when all arguments, you know, kind of fell apart for me. about my senior year, junior senior year, I actually, it was my sophomore year, middle of my sophomore year, I put away my Bibles. It was like, I need to listen. I need to learn more. I need to understand these people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably my junior year or so. My mom was really open to this idea. I don't know why. Judaism wasn't going to do it for me because that was the beginning of the story and there was no end. Christianity was the middle, right? This big crescendo leading up to something. And still didn't give me any answers. I was like, Islam has got to be it. And so I was,
it's the final revelation after all, right?
That's right. It's the final call. Wait a minute. Right. That's the wrong religion. I looked at it and I said, you know, I'm going to throw myself into Islam because they've got to have the answers that neither one of these had. So a lot of my senior year and junior year as well, I was studying Islam, and it was all fine and dandy until my grandmother really started to break me down, because she was breaking down. She says, "You're going to go to hell," right?
Hmm.
So I put that away. Yeah, I put Islam away. Hmm. Amazing how simple that was. But and then I jumped head back into Catholicism, and I said, there's got to be a way for me to figure this out. You know, this has been a bit of a mess, and maybe I just don't understand enough behind the religions and behind what made them what they are. And so one year into seminary, Catholic seminary, I spent studying the Bible and how not just the Bible and what it said, but the history behind its manufacturing, and I use that word very, very deliberately, the manufacturing of the Bible. And once you start to understand that, you're like, oh, I think I'm done. It was a very scary time for me, because I had seen a lot of the truth, and some of the people that had raised me up. My initial reaction was, how could you lie to me? I mean, I've been lied to all my life. I mean, 20 years of being fed this, and why would you do that to me? To which the response is, they don't think that they're lying. They believe, many of these are true believers. So why didn't they question the way that I did? What's wrong with me, right? I mean, there were a lot of internalized struggles that I had with it. As I've toured the country having these conversations with people and Black apostasy, I've run into people who have dealt with serious depression transitioning from the church to secularism, right? It's like, wait, this destroys my worldview. What do you mean I'm not chosen? It's almost like losing a parent for some people. And I get that. I mean, I had that I was having a conversation with my pseudo father who wasn't there, but I was having this conversation with them all the time. So just to realize that, no, you weren't having a conversation with anyone at all that time wasted or whatever. I mean, it can make a lot of people angry and or bitter. I was neither. I had come to the realization that, you know what? It just is. And then I went through a phase of, I've got to educate everyone on, you're being lied to, right? At which point, of course, reality is people don't want to hear it. They will hold on to their beliefs almost to the point of disowning you, which is what eventually happened to me. When so now I'm in my early 20s. Alex doesn't go to church anymore. I'm spiritual but not religious, and that's as far as it goes. Spiritual but not religious. I knew what I was, but nobody was gonna get me to admit that I, an A what? No, no. Especially at the time, because I knew what those costs were. Again, you mentioned social suicide. Those were the exact words that I used, maybe 10, 15 years ago, because when when you take a look at our resources, you know, Black resources, they are tied very close to the church, not because it's the church, but it's because it's community.
Right.
I mean, when you, I mean, same thing with the civil rights era. You know, people often talk about, you know, it was God that liberated Blacks in America. It's like, oh, wait, the same God that allowed the enslavement. Hold on a second. And you often get the parallels of, you know, Moses with, you know, Dr. King, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the names that you hear associated with the civil rights movement are usually Dr. Reverend something so-and-so, or even Malcolm. But even Malcolm was a religious man. Mm-hmm. In context. He was a religious man in context. But these are the echoes that often get repeated over and over and over again. And so you don't hear about the A. Philip Randolph.
Exactly.
And even Baldwin and the other secularists that were around that enabled the march, that enabled Dr. King. We don't talk about Dr. King condemning Christianity when he did, you know, letters from the Birmingham jail. I mean, that's an indictment, right, of the church in general. And I mean, there's a long history of that. So trying to shake someone out of that belief system and say, you don't need the church, well, I still need those resources. I still need access to, okay, it's not a healthcare thing, but I need daycare. I need access to the dating pool. I need access to networking. I need access to everything that humans typically need. Mm-hmm. We could get within a circle or two or a degree or two from away from the church. It's a great way of climbing the social ladder. So again, I didn't want to say I am an atheist because again, there was social suicide and I still needed access to that. Got my kids, you know, started my family. And one of the first questions that I would get is, you know, is my son baptized, blah, blah, you know, godmother, godfather, all that stuff, right? It's like, how are you going to take care of his spiritual raising? Who's going to help you spiritually do that? And it's like, you know what? I didn't actually need any of that. I mean, it was nice when we talked about it conceptually. You remove the spirituality associated with it or the supernaturalism associated with that. It's like, this is just good advice. And so I plan on being there for my son as long as I can, make sure that I can surround him and the rest of my family with good people, with good intentions and resources to boot. I think we're going to be okay. Now, that eventually led to September 11th, I think it was September 12th or 13th, that September 11th, that I actually used the word atheist for me. And I was like, oh yeah, no, nope. I understand the ideology that enabled this. Mm-hmm. I understand the ideology that believes that has been targeted. And I'm going to tell you that that same God would agree to both of that, right? To both of that, or the justification for the attack, et cetera. I mean, you could twist it. And a God that would allow something to happen, something like that to happen. Yeah, I'm good. Now, I don't believe in it. I'm not angry about it, but I'm okay saying that I don't have to get on a plane on September 13th and see someone, which happened, and see someone in abject misery looking for their lost ones and them looking at me and saying, why did God allow this? I don't have to lie to them. I just don't. I'm there. I'm here for you. But I don't have to lie to you. I don't have to justify my God to you anymore, not in face of that evil. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of liberating. That was the word. That's, you know, from then on, I had absolutely no issue ever using the word atheist. Never again. And people ask, oh, are you humanist? Yeah, I'm also a humanist, but oh no, I'm an atheist. Yeah.
Okay. I think you mentioned earlier that, I believe you said you credit your mother for you cut your mother for you eventually becoming an atheist. and you read my Pathos piece, correct?
Yes.
I don't know, at the very beginning, the first paragraph of that essay, I wrote about a conversation I was having with a cousin of mine, because I had interviewed Mandisa Thomas a few months back. And
never heard of her.
she's an amazing woman for sure.
Yes, she is. Yeah.
But so my cousin, this older cousin of mine, listened to the interview, and she was like, you could tell just in our conversation, she had never had a real conversation with someone who was a non-believer, someone who was an atheist. She had never had a conversation with them. And she was like, I just don't get it. I don't understand. How can you not believe? And I just broke it down for her as best as I could. And she said something to me that was really, that really hurt. Cause I'm kind of used to people asking me, as an atheist, you have to get used to people not understanding your perspective.
That's right.
A way of life.
That's right.
But
yeah,
she was like, my cousin told me, she was like, your mother should have raised you in the church more when you were younger, you know, so you wouldn't have to be the way that you are now. I was like, wow. And I was like, my mom gave me, I was fortunate enough to live in a household. My mom is very, very conservative Christian, but she raised me to be a thinking man. She raised me to be a thinking man. Like we still disagree in that area of religion, but like, I can say there's respect there. There's respect. So I guess in a sense, I can kind of relate to that about like your parents kind of putting you on a certain pathway, maybe indirectly, it's there. I guess I want to ask you about when it comes to being a Black atheist, how do you fare? I'll use my own case. I've never, as a Black non-believer, I've never tended to be in humanist groups, well, just something completely different, but or atheist groups in cities where I live, because I know those are predominantly white spaces. I don't want to go through the stairs. I don't want to go through the ridiculous questions that I know I'm going to be asked. And I think many white atheists, I feel like a lot of them really don't understand. It's almost like you're like I kind of mentioned in the piece, it's almost like you're fighting a war on two fronts. So you have to deal with the kind of, you know, being a pariah within your own community, and then going into the atheist community, which is predominantly white. So there are obviously cultural differences. You have to deal with being an outsider there too. So my question is, how do you navigate that?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a great question. If I had given up, the very first time I went to an atheist group, I was the only Black person there. Literally, I was the only Black person. Mm-hmm. It was like maybe 40, 50 people. I was the only Black person. Now I'm Black person there. Like, okay. This should not surprise me. It does not surprise me. I went back maybe two more times and I'm like, I am freaking invisible. Literally, no one knows how to come in and have a conversation with me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they're like, oh, you know, Black guy, I wonder what he's here for, or whatever. right? It's just one of those things, right? I mean, really.
Yeah.
But for me is, I, you know, my day job, I work in corporate America, so you have to learn to, you know, turn it on and off.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not uncommon for me to walk into, for the most part, walk into a meeting and still be the only Black person there, mm-hmm. or be in I'm not exaggerating. I am in IT, I'm in corporate America IT, And I went 15 years being the only black person in my department. And that's two companies. That spanned two companies. 15 years, only black person in my department. At one point, I was the only black person in my division. And so the brunt of it was, okay, Alex, how are you going to navigate your own career and make the connections that you need to make to advance and or survive? And this is one of the problems that I think many of us face, because we are still highly segregated, right? I mean, not just in corporate America, but in real world. And so people, you know, going back to the humanist and atheist groups, they didn't know how to, and I was about to give up on them. I was done. I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm just done. Mm-hmm. And one guy came up and started having a conversation with me, and he was smart, intelligent. Actually, he's one of my best friends now, Dr. Zachary Moore. And he sat down and we had a conversation, and he wanted to understand, like, why do we see so few black atheists and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, interesting you should say that. It's like the first three times that I come here, nobody's talking. I'm the invisible man. Nobody knows how to deal with me. Now, I took that, again, I took that personally for a little bit, but I knew not to. Mm-hmm. Because I had this expectation of, well, these are humanists. They're smart. They're, you know, humanists and atheists. They're smart. They're intelligent. Biases don't exist. Now, this was many years ago now. You know, they've got to be better than the typical average Joe. They can see the truth of this. They're, therefore, they've got to be easier to talk to. And reality is, we've settled on one of the easiest questions that has popped up in our own lives. Like, is there or isn't there a God? No, we agree on that. Sometimes that's the only thing that we will agree on. And that's something that Matt Dillahunty just puts nailed perfectly years ago. Why would any white person, regardless of what they believe in God, know how to interact with a black person, given that they live in their segregated world? And so when we start looking at cultural analysis, socioeconomic analysis, it's like we still inherit a lot of these cultural beliefs that exist in America, period. It doesn't matter whether we believe in God or not. We have people that believe that racism doesn't exist. I mean, seriously, I mean, there's an argument out there that we shouldn't have black spaces at all. We should be working towards true assimilation, you know. I gave a talk in Milwaukee. It was last year. And it wasn't MythCon. It was a different one. And we're talking about racism and arguing about race within the overall atheist community, the ones that do choose to coalesce and be communities. And in the shadow of having something like a Mythicist Milwaukee convention where social justice, everything is being attacked, feminism is being attacked, identity politics is being attacked. Mm-hmm. In the wake of having a president like the one that we have, right, minimizing everything that is identity politics and blah, 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 social justice, you know, snowflakes are being triggered. MythCon is having conversations that almost require that you defend your identity as a whole, as a black person, period. Doesn't matter how good you are. Doesn't matter how well off you are. You have to defend everything that is you. And so I did not attend MythCon. I was asked to speak and I said no, because I'm not going to take any part of any of that, because certain things are not debatable. For me anyway, it's like, yeah, you can argue all you want, but does me being a black man, I mean, is that debatable anyway? So I'm in another conference and I'm speaking, and in the shadow of all of that entire backdrop, it happened to be a white gentleman that stands up and wants to know, but what are we going to do about black racism? And I said, what do you mean black racism? Well, I guess it's too early to start talking about how black people hate white people and how black people are oppressing white people. Like,
Yeah.
Right. And so these are the dialogues that you would expect to see just outside, and you're just bringing it inside, and you just have a different group. Again, being atheist, Mandy likes it. She laughs at when I, being atheist isn't magic. It's not magic.
It is not magic.
And it isn't magical. It doesn't inoculate you from any other bias. And whether it's a cognitive bias or the way that you process things, you know, people have different cognitive schema, et cetera. But it doesn't inoculate you either way. You can be sexist, you can be racist, you can add any kind of ist or ism at the end of it. You can be pro this, anti that, doesn't matter. You're still going to bring that as you cohere who you are, as you cohere your own identity, as you define who you are, whether it's a white nationalist, right, black, irrelevant.
Yeah.
You're going to carry that baggage. Again, the only thing that we agree on is.
Being an atheist doesn't divorce you from your social context, essentially. So,
correct.
What would you, for a young person, a young black person, say someone growing up in the deep South, I think the South is a different kind of animal. For a young black person growing up in the deep South, what advice, who's skeptical about religion? What advice would you give them in terms of trying to assert themselves as a non-believer, as an atheist?
As long as you're going to be safe, do it. Now, I live in the South. I've lived in the South for, some people would say, Texas ain't the South. It's like, it's a different country altogether. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's true. I mean, you know, we actually, you know, a lot of people don't even know what Juneteenth is. I didn't know what Juneteenth was, you know, growing up in New York. It was like, mm-hmm. Juneteenth, that's when everyone else found out that they were free.
Right. Like,
you know, the last time that actually happened was in Texas. And even then they were ready to, you know, throw down some more. I'm like, of course, that's how, anyway, it's the last bastion of the Confederacy. One is you're actually not alone. When I Googled black atheist, way back when, no names came up. I mean, there were the Norm Allens and black humanists and stuff like that. And it was actually when I got involved with the African Americans for Humanism, several years ago. A funny story is my wife surprised me and she said, hey, I'm putting you on a plane and sending you to DC. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool, this is cool. And she says, I'm not going to tell you why until you're there. And then she tells me, it's like, okay, this surprise was when it was my birthday. And she says, sending you to the African American for Humanism summit, and this is going to be a group of black humanists and atheists out there. And she tells me this, and I'm laughing, right? I am just absolutely laughing. I said, so you just sent me to D.C. to have lunch with, like, three people is what you did. That's what you did. And I go up, and I don't remember the name of the restaurant, but I walk into the restaurant, and I'm expecting to see a small table of maybe a handful of black non-believers. You know, I was like, best case scenario, maybe it's a dozen. I walk in, and there's, like, 20. I'm like, oh, wow, this is some of the names I knew, you know, were Facebook friends, and some people I had never met.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was the very next day, there was at CFI, Center for Inquiry in DC, we were going to have a little bit of a, you know, speaking thing and convention. And I walk in there and I am in awe. I am just numb. There were, I think the final count was 60, 70 people.
Wow.
And at the time it was it wound up being the largest organized meeting of Black non-believers at the time. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, at the time, like, this was huge, you know. Sikivu Hutchinson was there, you know, several other people. This was an amazing thing for what it was. And when I got back home, I just had this feeling of not being alone. And that was important. And so I would tell someone in the South that, number one, you're not alone. You may be alone in a couple of your pockets. Well, that's what social media is for. You can connect. You can find other people. Mm-hmm. As long as you are not, you know, as long as you're safe, come out, start talking to people, connect with people, get online, connect with them. And as soon as you can, get offline and go meet them. One of the things that I've been very proud of, very happy to see is, you know, not just Black skeptics, but Black non-believers. I think we have 13 chapters now. You know, it was Black non-believers of Atlanta. Then it was, you know, two more, and then Black non-believers of Dallas, Black non-believers of New York, Black DC. I mean, you pick it. I mean, there's, and I don't think they're slowing down. I mean, change happens. But we're out there and we're seeing these wonderful Black magnets of non-belief that are generating, creating these tipping points in these areas in the South is where we need it the most, quite honestly. Because it's not just about being non-Christian. It's about liberation. It's about freeing your mind. It's about, you know, moving forward. And for me, that's what continues to drive and propel my activism. It's, I don't see it very distinguishable from liberation as a whole. You know, it's, if you're going to free yourself, free yourself. And you've got to remove the shackles. Some of them are physical, some of them are socioeconomic, some of them are mental. Mm-hmm. And some of them you need to really, you know, take a good look and make a decision that you're going to shed. And when you do, understand that you're not standing by yourself, you're not standing alone, and you're standing on this wonderful, rich, beautiful Black heritage of free thought that existed long before you.
Right. I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote that essay, is because what I wrote, I had wished I had saw something like that as a teenager. I wish I could have saw that as a teenager. And I just kind of wanted people to know that, like, hey, you're not alone. You're not alone. And I'm also glad that, I think one of the central points I was trying to point out in that essay was that just kind of the need to engage in more critical thinking, the need to engage in more critical thinking. Not, I mean, it's amazing to me how people compartmentalize things. Like, we'll be critical of just about everything except for our religion.
Yep.
That amazes me. Did you see the recent Pew study? I think it was pertaining to Black millennials, their religiosity compared to white millennials, which is more. They're more religious than their white counterparts.
Yeah.
But they're less religious than their parents. Or
big time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of that? What do you make of that?
When I started tracking the numbers, it was back in, I want to say it was the 2011-2012 ARIS survey, which was the largest, because that's when you get the really big numbers, not the Pew numbers. Pew and Gallup, you know, they're good numbers, but sometimes the ARIS, which I think is actually run by Pew Research, but every few years, you know, those are some really, you know, good numbers. And we were at 95% to 97% religiosity as a race in America. Black Americans were 95% of Black Americans that responded to the survey, I still remember this, said that religion was highly important in their lives versus 70%.
95.
Versus 70% of the general population. And at the time, we saw Hispanics leaving the church as a whole more than African Americans. It's like the church has done so much for you. That's anyway.
Wow.
But I mean, yeah, that's 95%. And again, there's a lot of reasons why we can attribute it that way. Tradition is the big ones, right? I mean, yes, it was beat into you or beat into your ancestors, and then it became part of tradition, and we kept it because, especially in America, you know, how do you define what Black is? It's not uniquely African, and it's American without the privilege. You know what I'm saying? So it is something that is very unique. And so we created this identity of what Black is, and it's like, okay, this is it. But as we saw numbers begin to just, you know, flow away, and education had a big implication in the general population. The more educated you were, the less likely you were to be, you know, religious, period. And then we had, you know, when you start taking a look at the stratification of education, so you start looking at the boomers, which were more religious, the Gen Xers, which were less religious, and then, you know, as we look at the millennials, the Zillennials, et cetera, and so they're becoming, just flat out, they're becoming less religious. So that's the trajectory we're going to have, because people are going to be more educated, although we do have particular pockets within government that want a non-educated majority, because that keeps them in power. That's the nature of not just American government, but that's the nature of some of societies just across the world. I mean, you can examine it in Africa, Rwanda, Ghana. You see that. I mean, corruption tends to, you know, just be there and endemic in some of these systems. Mm-hmm. So you don't want a fully educated mass in certain areas, because power, money, control, power, money, respect. So I think that because we do see a little bit more economic growth, higher rates of employment, mm-hmm. People are at least more as better off today as they than they were 30, 40, 50 years ago. You're going to see people let go. And then there's some education and social media. You have to take a look at everything associated with that. I will say, and there's a different aspect of my activism, which does tend to focus on not religion per se, but on liberation and talking about cultural Black issues. Mm-hmm. That when I'm out in the streets, when I am talking to young organizers, Black Lives Matter organizers, et cetera, when I'm talking to people in Baltimore and Ferguson, there's an interesting sentiment that comes up now that I didn't see 20 years ago, which is, you know, why aren't we seeing Reverend blah, blah, blah in front of, you know, Black Lives Matter, et cetera? Why aren't they the ones there? And sometimes we actually hear, what is the church doing for us? What is your God doing for us? I mean, you know, it didn't work 20 years ago. It didn't work 30 years ago. We need new faces, new blood, new attitude, mm-hmm. and we need a more aggressive stance. And so I think there's, you know, it's kind of hard to say it's one thing, unless it's, you know, us, our particular time and place. And I think that it bodes well for secularism in the Black community. It's going to happen. Yeah. If we can learn to stop taking money out of the Black community and putting it into the hands of people like a Creflo Dollar, and leave it in the community.
He needs to have his multi-million-dollar plane to spread the word. I mean, he just has to
his jet. That's right. That's right.
But yeah, it was interesting what you were saying about the young people noticing, like in Black Lives Matter, noticing the lack of church leaders, in alliance with their movement. I don't know if you recall this, but I believe it was when Ferguson popped off a few years back. Jesse Jackson went down to Ferguson.
I was there the day after.
They said they didn't want him out there. They said they didn't want him.
That's right. That's right. I was out there the day after. I mean, like, seriously, the day after the first ride, I'm like, I need to get on a plane. Bye. They didn't want him there because the last thing that they needed to talk about was peace and how we shall overcome. Mm-hmm. And with the younger activists, I find that I think that they tend to be a little bit more or less measured and very critical about what hasn't worked in the past. Mm-hmm. Right. So, being able to say, hey, Jesse, you got to go. We don't want to talk about the moral compliance, that aspect of religion right now. We don't want to make up because, one, we haven't mourned. Two, we haven't dealt with any real justice. So until we get through a couple of those phases in life, you and, I guess it was Franklin Graham, right after Ferguson was ready to send ministers to go help with the healing process. Like, no, hold on. Healing process? Why is Black communities always, you always want to talk about the healing process and forgiveness when you haven't dealt with the justice? You haven't dealt with the remediation of what got us here in the first place. It's just, I personally love that, there was that kid in New York City that, there was a woman that said that, she was sexually assaulted in a store by a young Black man there. And she was like maybe 14 years old. And I'm hearing the story and I'm feeling the whole Emmett Till goosebumps. I'm like, oh my God, this is in the South, even 10 years ago, kid's dead. And I'm listening to the story and it turns out that there was a camera. And so there was videotape, which is, it doesn't work all the time, but the videotape showed that this woman, what this woman said happened didn't happen at all.
Right.
And they were talking or interviewing the little boy a couple of, like 2 weeks afterwards. They're like, no, I'm not going to forgive her. No. And I'm like, who else would be asked to forgive her?
Yeah.
Why are you taking that away? Because that makes so much more internal. So you've got to be able to go through those processes. Forgiveness may or may not come. Mm-hmm. So,
I do think sometimes our people are a bit way too forgiving. And I think the powers that be that oppress us kind of count on that, us being forgiving.
Absolutely. This is Charleston. Mm-hmm. All of these things is like, we want to talk about forgiveness immediately after some of this happens. Again, let's use the power of God in healing and make sure that we don't have a situation like Baltimore, Ferguson, or LA, or the other places. Like, we need more godliness. No, what you need is justice.
True. I agree. There was something, and I'll, I guess we can end on this note. But there was something that, the recent shooting in California, a mother of one of the victims was interviewed by the press, and she essentially said, I don't want your prayers. I don't want your thoughts. She said, I want gun control.
Gun control.
Exactly. I stood up and clapped when I heard that. I was like, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you taking time on your Sunday to talk to me.
You're very welcome.
It means a lot. And can you tell people how they can, say, keep up with the news about you or your latest writings or anything like that?
Right. Yeah. You can catch me on Twitter. And it's Alex331 on Twitter. And then on Facebook, it is Alix, mm-hmm. Jules, Jules. So you can, anything that is social media related, if whether it's an appearance or writing or big announcements, you can find it there. And, you know, I try and keep up with that as much as I can. I'm fairly politically active as well. So okay. I'm always posting something. Yeah.
Okay. And what about your, you have a Patheos blog, don't you?
That's right. I'm on hiatus now, but okay. I'm on a hype, but it's the graffiti wall on Patheos. And then also I write for The Orbit, and this is just Alex Jules at The Orbit. For that, so, orbit.net, and that's with Greta Christina and Stephanie Tran and some of the other.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, again, thank you for taking your time out of your Sunday to talk to me. And
it was a pleasure. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right. You have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Bye.
Have a bye.